Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. If you're into diet and nutrition at all, certainly you've run into the paleo diet or the ketogenic diet. And I'd like to start off with that. This from JAMA Network. The ketogenic diet for obesity and diabetes. Enthusiasm outpace evidence. The ketogenic diet has recently received much attention for its promise for treating obesity and type 2 diabetes. However, the enthusiasm for its potential benefits exceeds the current evidence supporting its use for these conditions. Although the temptation is great to recommend a potentially novel approach for otherwise difficult to treat diseases, it is important to remain grounded in our appraisal of the risks, benefits, and applicability of a diet to avoid unnecessary harm and cost to patients. The ketogenic diet, or keto diet, emerged in popularity after a recent series of other low-carbohydrate diets, such as the paleo and Atkins diets. The ketogenic diet is unique from other low-carbohydrate diets in that followers of the diet are encouraged to forego nearly all carbohydrates, avoid excess protein, and consume high levels of fat, generally exceeding 70% of calories consumed, resulting in the production of ketones, giving the diet its name. The excitement for low-carbohydrate diets comes on the heels of what some have considered the failure of a low-fat diet to curb the obesity epidemic and its associated increase in type 2 diabetes. This enthusiasm is belied by the fact that the modern diet is not truly low in fat, defined as less than 30% of total calories. Of more importance, from the early 1970s to the early 2000s, Americans increased total energy consumption by at least 240 calories per day, likely contributing to weight gain and the increased incidence of diabetes. Is the ketogenic diet more effective for weight loss than other diets? In a meta-analysis of 13 studies lasting longer than a year, researchers found that the ketogenic diet was associated with less than a kilogram of additional weight loss over high-carbohydrate, low-fat strategies. This difference, although statistically significant, may not be clinically significant. Furthermore, a meta-analysis of 32 controlled feeding studies found that energy expenditure and fat loss were greater with low-fat diets compared with ketogenic diets. Any diet that results in weight loss does so because it reduces calorie intake. The ketogenic diet, when used for weight loss, is no different. The salient questions are whether it is sustainable and whether it promotes long-term health. No studies, to our knowledge, have evaluated ketogenic diet for cardiovascular events or mortality, although observational studies in the broader low-carbohydrate diet literature suggest increased all-cause mortality. What about the role of a ketogenic diet in the treatment of type 2 diabetes? One publicized non-randomized study of the ketogenic diet in persons with type 2 diabetes showed a 1.3% reduction in glycosylated hemoglobin at 1 year in the ketogenic group. Okay, I have to stop there and do some editorializing. First of all, 1.3% doesn't seem like much, but what they're measuring, this glycosylated hemoglobin, is actually a long-term measure of your average blood glucose. And like a normal level is like 5 or 6. And when they talk about a 1.3% reduction, what they mean is a 1.3% reduction from like 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, which would be what a diet diabetics glycosylated hemoglobin. So actually, that was probably, for the lay public, it'd be better to talk about like a 10 or 20% decrease in the glycosylated hemoglobin. Continuing, these findings must be interpreted with caution, however, because the ketosis group was self-selected and received intensive technological and behavioral support not offered in the control group. And again, I remind you, this was a non-randomized study. Long-term, that is greater than 1 year randomized studies, tell a different story. A meta-analysis of randomized long-term studies comparing the ketogenic diet with low-fat diets for weight loss reported no significant differences in glycemic control, that's blood sugar control, among persons with type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is characterized by carbohydrate intolerance due to insulin resistance. Restriction of carbohydrates, as in the ketogenic diet, can temporarily improve glycemic control and weight loss by any means can improve insulin resistance. However, there is little, if any, evidence that ketogenic diets specifically improve carbohydrate intolerance independent of weight loss. Unlike other dietary approaches in which glycemic control is improved despite the consumption of healthful carbohydrate-rich foods such as legumes, whole grains, and fruits, even in the absence of weight loss. In terms of the risk-benefit balance of the ketogenic diet, the potential adverse effects may give one pause. A review of the literature on ketogenic diets for the treatment of pediatric epilepsy reveals multiple adverse effects, ranging from the relatively benign but inconvenient keto flu, an induction period of fatigue, weakness, and gastrointestinal disturbances, to the less common but deadly occurrences of cardiac arrhythmias from selenium deficiency. Other documented adverse effects include kidney stones, constipation, bad breath, muscle cramps, headaches, diarrhea, restricted growth, bone fractures, pancreatitis, and multiple vitamin mineral deficiencies. The greatest risk, however, of the ketogenic diet may be the one most overlooked. Okay, people, I'm going to repeat that again. The greatest risk, however, of the ketogenic diet may be the one most overlooked. Here we go. The opportunity cost of not eating high-fiber, unrefined carbohydrates. Whole grains, fruits, and legumes are some of the most health-promoting foods on the planet. They are not responsible for the epidemics of type 2 diabetes or obesity, and their avoidance may do harm. In a systematic review and meta-analysis of 45 prospective studies, researchers found that whole grain intake was associated with a dose-dependent reduction in risk of coronary heart disease, cardiovascular disease, total cancer, and all-cause mortality. Similar findings have been seen with fruits and legumes. Nearly all experts agree that highly processed, refined carbohydrate-rich foods should be avoided. Blurring the distinction between refined and unrefined carbohydrates, and thus excluding both, precludes the numerous health benefits of unrefined carbohydrates. Some of the longest living populations in the so-called blue zone communities subsist on a carbohydrate fare that exceeds 50% of daily calories. Although the ketogenic diet has garnered much attention for the dietary treatment of chronic diseases such as obesity and type 2 diabetes, the evidence supporting its use is currently limited and the diet's potential risks are real. Physicians and patients should continue to judiciously appraise the benefits and risks of the ketogenic diet in accordance with the evidence, not the hype. Well, as many of you know, I am convinced that a whole food, plant-based diet is the healthiest diet for the general population. And I think this is where the keto diet and often the related paleo diet goes wrong. These can be very good, actually, behaviorally in getting people to eliminate so-called bad carbohydrates, that is, unrefined carbohydrates. Virtually nobody really thinks that's a bad thing to reduce, quote, bad carbohydrates, the refined carbohydrates. And in fact, that is a lot of the American diet. So this is a very important point. But as this article wisely pointed out, we shouldn't throw the good carbohydrates out with the bad. So enjoy those healthy carbohydrates, beans, whole grains, fruits, and vegetables. Okay, well, here at Just for the Health of It, I promote a sustainable diet, that is one that's healthy for individuals, communities, and the planet. And this seems to me to be the decisive thing about going to a whole foods plant-based diet. It's a sustainability issue. One of my previous episodes, I laid out a long litany of reasons why if you want to be a serious environmentalist, we need to move away from animal-based foods. So here it is from The Guardian. New plant-focused diet would transform plants' future, says scientists. The first science-based diet that tackles both the poor food eaten by billions of people and averts global environmental catastrophe has been devised. It requires huge cuts in red meat eating in Western countries and radical changes across the world. The Planetary Health Diet was created by an international commission seeking to draw up guidelines that provide nutritious food to the world's fast-growing population. At the same time, the diet addresses the major role of farming, especially livestock, in driving climate change, the destruction of wildlife, and the pollution of rivers and oceans. Globally, the diet requires red meat and sugar consumption to be cut by half, while vegetables, fruit, legumes, and nuts must double. But in specific places, the changes are stark. North Americans need to eat 84% less red meat, but 6 times more beans and lentils. For Europeans, eating 77% less red meat and 15 times more nuts and seeds meets the guidelines. The diet is a win-win, according to the scientists, as it would save at least 11 million people a year from deaths caused by unhealthy food, while preventing the collapse of the natural world that humanity depends on. That's nice. With 10 billion people expected to live on Earth by 2050, a continuation of today's unsustainable diets would inevitably mean even greater health problems and severe global warming. Unhealthy diets are the leading cause of ill health worldwide, with 800 million people currently hungry, 2 billion malnourished, and a further 2 billion people overweight or obese. The World Science Academies recently concluded that the food system is broken. Industrial agriculture is also devastating the environment, as forests are razed and billions of cattle emit climate-warming methane. The world's diets must change dramatically, says Walter Willett at Harvard University and one of the leaders of the commission convened by the Lancet Medical Journal and the EAT Forum NGO. The report, published in The Lancet and being launched to policymakers in 40 cities around the world, also concluded that food waste must be reduced in half, down to 15%. Humanity now poses a threat to the stability of the planet, said Professor Johan Rockström at the Stockholm Resilience Center, Sweden, another author of the report. This requires nothing less than a new global agricultural revolution. Farm yields in poorer nations must be improved to create a sustainable, healthy world, the report found. The Planetary Health Diet is largely plant-based and allows an average of 2,500 calories a day. It allows 1 beef burger and 2 servings of fish a week, but most protein comes from pulses and nuts. Pulses is an English term for legumes or beans, for those of you that might not know that. A glass of milk a day or some cheese or butter fits within the guidelines, as does an egg or two a week. Half of each plate of food under the diet is vegetables and fruit, and a third is whole grain cereals. Willett said these provide the ingredients for a flexible and varied diet. We are not talking about a deprivation diet here. We are talking about a way of eating that can be healthy, flavorful, and enjoyable. The numbers for red meat sound small to a lot of people in the UK or US, he said. But they don't sound small to the very large part of the world's population that already consumes about that much or even less. It is very much in line with traditional diets. The Planetary Health Diet is based on really hard epidemiological evidence where researchers followed large cohorts of people for decades, says Marco Springman at Oxford University and part of the commission. It so happens that if you put all that evidence together, you get a diet that looks similar to some of the healthiest diets that exist in the real world. The report acknowledges the radical change it advocates and the difficulty of achieving it. Humanity has never aimed to change the global food system on the scale envisioned. Achieving this goal will require rapid adoption of numerous changes and unprecedented global collaboration and commitment, nothing less than the Great Food Transformation. But Richard Horton and Tamara Lucas, editors at The Lancet, said in an editorial that global changes as set out by the Planetary Health Diet were essential. Civilization is in crisis. We can no longer feed our population a healthy diet while balancing planetary resources. If we can eat in a way that works for our planet as well as our bodies, the natural balance will be restored. And my friends, that's what Just for the Health of It is all about. Okay, let's get on with the public health news and research roundup, where I take a critical look at all the public health stuff going on so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up, from Science Daily, this as a little bit of follow-up for a previous study that talked about the brutality on one's health for people going through medical residency, this story is capping medical residency hours does not hamper new doctors' quality of training. When new rules capped training hours for medical residents at 80 hours per week in 2003, critics worried that the change would leave physicians in training unprepared for the challenges of independent practice. New research shows that these dire warnings were largely unjustified. The analysis, believed to be the first national study examining the impact of reduced hours on physician performance, found no evidence that reduced training hours had any impact on the quality of care delivered by new physicians. Following a series of high-profile patient injuries and deaths believed to stem from clinical errors caused by fatigue, medical accreditation agencies initiated a series of sweeping changes to the regulations governing residents' hours and other aspects of training. These efforts culminated in 2003 with the U.S. Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education capping the training of medical residents at 80 hours per week. This is probably the most hotly debated topic in medical education among physicians. Many doctors trained under the old system think that today's residents don't get enough training under the new system. You hear a lot of senior physicians looking at younger doctors coming out of training and saying, they're not as prepared as we were. The findings of the study should assuage those fears. We found no evidence that the care provided by physicians who trained under the 80-hour-a-week model is suboptimal. Okay, in a somewhat related story from Stat News, we love primary care. Why are our trainees so discouraged by it? We are alarmed and confused when the residents we train choose to leave primary care. We agree wholeheartedly with a number of the issues they cite. The electronic medical record with its primary service to the billing department rather than the patient, the unfair reimbursement for non-procedural specialties, the overwhelming debt burden from medical training, the long hours, and the complex social and emotional contexts that complicate our patients' care. These are undeniable barriers that sap the joy and satisfaction that come from providing the longitudinal coordination of care, advocacy, clinical reasoning, and caring that are the core of primary care. A call to overhaul primary care and deconstruct it into newly specialized and more manageable pieces worries us as being potentially problematic for the health of the public. Since ample evidence documents better health indicators and higher patient satisfaction in societies that have robust primary care systems, fixing primary care doesn't lie in turning away from it, but rather in working together to create a system in which physicians can effectively lead interdisciplinary teams in providing high-value and equitable health care to the populations they serve. The dominant values of the environment in which medical students and residents learn medicine shape their experiences, the lessons they absorb, and the solutions they envision. We must train a cohort of young physicians who see themselves as change agents and who embrace and advance the mission of primary care, to improve the health of the public through a continuous relationship with a caring provider who provides first access to care, coordinates treatment and preventive efforts, and advocates for patients in an often complex system. We must also clear away the obstacles and ensure that residents learn and train in an environment that promotes, rather than undermines, a vibrant primary care system that is at its core, that is at the core of a rational and effective health system.
Next up, from Science Daily, study asked people with mental health disorders to recommend changes to international diagnostic guidelines. A Rutgers University researcher contributed to the first study to seek input from people with common mental health issues on how their disorders are described in diagnostic guidelines. The study, which was conducted by researchers in the United Kingdom and the United States in collaboration with the World Health Organization Department of Mental Health, appears in The Lancet. Including people's personal experiences and disorders in diagnostic manuals will improve their access to treatment and reduce stigma, said Margaret Swarbrick, an adjunct associate professor and director of practice innovation and wellness at Rutgers University, who collaborated with Kathleen Pike, executive director and scientific co-director of the Global Mental Health Program on the U.S. portion of the study. The researchers talked to people with five common disorders: schizophrenia, bipolar disorder type 1, depressive episode, personality disorder, and generalized anxiety disorder, about how their conditions should be described in the upcoming 11th revision of the International Classification of Diseases and Related Health Problems, otherwise known as the ICD-11. The ICD is the most widely used classification system for mental disorders. This is the first time people with diagnosed mental health disorders who are not health practitioners have been invited to give input on any published mental health diagnostic guidelines. The participants reviewed an initial draft of the ICD-11 chapter on mental, behavioral, and neurodevelopmental disorders and recommended changes to more accurately reflect their experiences and/or remove objectionable language. Many participants said the draft omitted emotional and psychological experiences they regularly have. People with schizophrenia added references to anger, fear, memory difficulties, isolation, and difficulty communicating internal experiences. People with bipolar added anxiety, anger, nausea, and increased creativity. People with generalized anxiety disorder added nausea and anger. People with depression added pain and anxiety. People with personality disorder added distress and vulnerability to exploitation. The participants also suggested removing confusing or stigmatizing terms such as retardation, neurovegetative, bizarre, disorganized, and maladaptive. We discovered that the current draft reflected an external perspective of these conditions rather than a perspective of the person's lived experience. This is a needed perspective for clinicians and researchers. Participants appreciated the non-technical summaries, which suggests that using such common language would go a long way in bridging the communication gap between the people being diagnosed and clinicians. Wow, that's kind of what I'd have to say to this. Wow, it's hard to believe that we've got through, I guess, 10 versions of this over decades, and we're actually asking people who suffer from the conditions what their experience is and how that might add something to the overall classification. Well, kudos, it's about time. Okay, in a somewhat related story from People.com, feeling anxious about climate change? Therapists say you're not alone. Therapist Andrew Bryant says the landmark United Nations climate report last October brought a new mental health concern to his patients. I remember being in sessions with folks the next day. They had never mentioned climate change before, and they were like, I keep hearing about this report, Bryant said. Some of them expressed anxious feelings, and we kept talking about it over our next sessions. Often these patients want to do something to reduce global warming, but are overwhelmed and depressed by the scope of the problem and difficulty in finding solutions. And they're anxious about how the earth will change over the rest of their and their children's lifetimes. Although it is not an official clinical diagnosis, psychiatric and psychological communities have names for the phenomenon: climate distress, climate grief, climate anxiety, or eco-anxiety. The concept is also gradually making its way into the public consciousness. An April survey by Yale and George Mason Universities found that 62% of Americans were at least somewhat worried about climate change. Of those, 23% were very worried. Alice and Laura started seeing a counselor for anxiety and depression in college. Eventually, she began working in building sustainability, where she helped businesses reduce their energy and water consumption. But a few years ago, she began talking to her therapist about the contradictions in her life. I saw corporations destroying the environment, but I was working for them, and I knew what they were doing was wrong, said Laura, 36, who lives in Atlanta. It was causing me mental anguish. My therapist advised me to take action on what I could control and try to find another area of work. I just couldn't work in an industry that was harming the earth. So how do people alleviate feelings of stress, anxiety, or depression surrounding the planet's fate? Good question. Bryant, the Seattle therapist, said the number one action he recommends is sharing these concerns with others, whether a counselor, psychiatrist, family, friends, or an activist group. There is a lot of underlying worry, but not a lot of dialogue or discussion. And so people feel isolated, Bryant said. Talking about it makes you feel less isolated. And it's also a way to relieve the tension, find a pathway forward, and find a purpose. In that vein, Dr. Janet Lewis, a psychiatry professor at the University of Rochester in New York, recommends building relationships within a like-minded group. That could involve group therapy, environmental activist groups, or online communities. For Laura, becoming involved with the international activist group Extinction Rebellion has helped her build a network of people who share her values and made her feel as if she's making a positive contribution to society. With the group, she has participated in nonviolent protests and is organizing the Atlanta chapter's first grief circle, where people can share their anxiety and grief about the destruction of the earth. Activism is also therapy for me, said Laura. Personal action is a way to take control of a situation in which you feel powerless, said Dr. Elizabeth Haas, a psychiatrist at Carson Tahoe Health in Carson City, Nevada. Small gestures such as taking fewer airline rides or buying local produce can actually make a difference. Susan Clayton, a psychology professor at the College of Worcester in Ohio, said one way to tackle the uncertainty of environmental change is learning how it might specifically affect your community by viewing climate model predictions. If you know what you're going to face, it's not quite as scary, said Clayton, who also co-authored the American Psychological Association's 2017 report on how climate change can affect mental health. Lewis said it's also crucial for people to remember that their mental health response to climate change is often valid. Most of the kinds of pathologies that we're accustomed to treating in psychiatry, they tend to be out of proportion to whatever is going on. But with climate change, this is not inappropriate, she explained. The goal is not to get rid of the anxiety. The goal is to transform it into what is bearable and useful and motivating. Amen to that. Okay, with a scarily changing world, let's end the show with some good news. This from the Christian Science Monitor. When water demand rises, this Montana town invests in forests. When Whitefish, Montana, a town of 7,000 nestled in the Rocky Mountains, saw rising demand for water, it gulped at the cost of trying to filter and treat dirtier water from its lake. This decision wasn't solely for the environment. Compared with man-made water treatment facilities, trees offer a cheap and efficient way to filter rain and snow. Indeed, they are so effective that five major U.S. cities, New York, Boston, Seattle, San Francisco, and Portland, can pump unfiltered water from distant, pristine watersheds to customer homes. Protecting forests and watersheds makes economic sense, says Whitefish Mayor John Mulfield, and it's a much different way of traditionally looking at a public water supply infrastructure. The model for this practice is New York City, which took the controversial step 2 decades ago of spending $2 billion to protect a watershed in the Catskill Mountains. The investment paid off. People are not necessarily doing it because they love trees, says University of Massachusetts ecologist Paul Barton, who says he coined the term forest to faucets. They are doing it because it's a lot less expensive. When the appetite for high-priced housing threatened the water source of this picturesque mountain town, the residents raised taxes and spent money on forests. 3 years later, when rising tourism upped the summer demand for water, more money was raised to buy more forests. The equation used by local and state officials, nonprofit groups, and private residents was straightforward. It's cheaper and easier to have forests cleanse the water than to throw chemicals and machinery at the task. Protecting forests of watersheds make economic sense, says John Muirfield, the mayor of this town of 7,000 nestled in Montana's Rocky Mountains, and it's a much different way of traditionally looking at a public water supply infrastructure. Whitefish's embrace of the idea of preserving forests to protect its water supply is evidence of the growing adoption of a tactic that once seemed risky and is now proving immensely successful for big cities and small towns alike. As town planners look at the high cost of building water filtration plants and operating them year after year, the thought of letting the trees do it becomes a budgetary no-brainer. And the trees do it well. The natural filtering process that rain and snow undergo in seeping through forest canopies and forest beds slowly towards streams and lakes is so effective that five major cities in the United States, New York, Boston, Seattle, San Francisco, and Portland, Oregon can pump unfiltered water from distant pristine watersheds to customers' homes. New York is the poster city example in this country. 20 years ago, the city engaged in a wrenching political battle over whether to build a $6 billion water filtration plant that would cost $300 million per year to filter water for the city. Instead, it gambled and spent $2 billion to protect a forested watershed in the Catskill Mountains, 125 miles away, the source of 90% of the city's water. It was a bold and controversial decision, and it worked. Here we are, 20 years later, they have been meeting the safe drinking water standards through tropical storms and superstorms, says Paul Barton, one of the junior architects of the original Catskills program, who now chairs a current National Academy review of the system. It has become an international example of what watershed protection can accomplish. People are not necessarily doing it because they love trees, he says. They're doing it because it's a lot less expensive, Dr. Barton says, as he coined the term forest of faucets, now used widely for the technique 15 years ago for a University of Massachusetts Amherst program he heads. Heidi Van Everen, executive director of the Whitefish Legacy Partners on the Whitefish Trail, created on property preserved for the town's drinking water. The deal appealed to everyone. It was good for water, recreation, wildlife, and scenic beauty, she says. The concept really wasn't new, Dr. Barton notes. The Swiss in the 1300s connected the dots. When we cleared the forest above our village, we have avalanches or soil losses that destroys the village. We couldn't do it. Europe widely adopted that conservation ethic, and still today preserves twice as much land proportionally as the U.S. The state and national park programs that began to emerge in the U.S. 150 years ago and evolved at the prodding of such visionaries as John Muir, Frederick Olmsted, Gifford Pinoche, and Teddy Roosevelt now preserve 13% of U.S. land, according to the World Bank. Another 56 million acres are held by various forms of private or public trusts that allow some use but prohibit development, according to the Land Trust Alliance in Washington, D.C. In the case of Whitefish, that meant keeping land for logging. The Hoskell Basin northeast of town was forest land owned for more than a century by the Stoltz Lumber Company. The city collected its water from two small streams on the property. Access to the water had always been guaranteed by no more than a gentleman's handshake, says Mayor Mulfield. But over the years, development pressures loomed larger as Whitefish blossomed into a high-end, expensive resort town sprouting multi-million dollar second homes. Stoltz could have gotten an offer that they couldn't refuse, says Chris Temple, a biologist at the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Agency. She and Alan Wood, a resource conservation manager at the agency, had been putting together conservation easements for years, but we had never done a project this expansive, says Mr. Wood in his office at Kalispell, where nail holes in the walls were covered by a bear hide. I didn't have a lot of confidence we could do it. The Trust for Public Lands thought they could. The nonprofit helped bring together $9 million from federal conservation funds, and Stoltz agreed to take a $4 million cut on the $21 million price of giving away development rights to its 3,000 acres in Haskell Basin. Once lands are developed, they are hard to undevelop, notes Dick Dolan, a director of the Trust for Public Land in Bozeman. We are trying to get ahead of the curve and preserve our future generations what we have. But that left a shortfall of $8 million. City residents had balked before about increasing the town's resort tax on restaurants, lodging, and retail. But in 2015, after a vote yes on water campaign by the mayor and others, residents gave an overwhelming 84% approval of a 1% tax increase. Late last year, the purchase of another 13,000-acre property helped protect a watershed for Whitehead Lake, a secondary source of water for the town. The public support is a change in a place where encroachment on private land is viewed with suspicion, says Mr. Wood. 20 years ago, there was a lot of opposition to these proposals, he said. People would say, you're spending money we don't have to lock up land we don't need. But this deal gave everyone what they wanted, said Mr. Wood. The town kept its access to clean and cheap water. Stoltz can keep harvesting timber on the land, employing an average of 110 workers. Lumber companies had crudely formed Whitefish. The original name was Stumptown, but Mr. Wood and others say the selective, sustainable timbering done by Stoltz is healthy for the forest. We've been doing it for over 100 years and we're able to find a balance. Just as important, perhaps, was guaranteeing public access to the forest. The deals will help a community group create a 55-mile trail around Whitefish. About 42 miles have been built and already a trail is used about 130,000 times a year by bikers, hikers, and joggers. When I moved here 12 years ago, people didn't want to talk about conservation, Miss Van Everen says, as four bikers steer carefully around her on the wooded trail, shaded by towering western red cedars and Douglas firs. It was too controversial. It was this left-wing crazy stuff. People now understand conservation means protecting our scenic backdrop, protecting our drinking water, supporting wildlife, allowing hunting, she says. I feel like there's so much more of let's find common ground and figure out what we can agree on. Well, that does it for today's show. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.